Farmers here in Arizona and in Southern California like to brag that this region produces almost all of the country's winter greens. In our story yesterday, we met farmer Jack Vesey in a field of romaine near the U.S.-Mexico border.
So if you're in New York City or in Washington, D.C. having a Caesar salad in February, there's about a 95% chance that it's come from this area grown with Colorado River water.
Not only are you eating lettuce from this area, but there is Colorado River water, for lack of a better way to describe it, in your body, nourishing you.
Yeah, no, very true, very true.
But as we've been hearing all week, the river is in peril. Too many people are drawing from it, and the drought is so bad that if states like California and Arizona don't make drastic cuts to their water use, the river could stop flowing past the dam at Lake Mead altogether. It would be a disaster for farms in Yuma and nearby Imperial County, California. And so, as our series on the river wraps up today, we're asking a provocative question. What if we needed far less water to grow our food? And what if we did it indoors? Well, that is exactly what Nate Story is doing 650 miles northwest of here in San Francisco. To go inside the Plenty Farm warehouse, you have to dress up head to toe in a protective suit and walk through a shallow bath of disinfectant.
Dunk your feet in there and we'll go on in here. Yeah, style in the farm is not a thing. This is not a place for style, so.
Story is a scientist and co-founder of this agricultural startup. He looks downright dashing in a hairnet and green latex gloves. The ventilation system is buzzing, and somewhere a giant robotic arm is sending a tower of greens through a harvesting machine.
What's growing here? We got lettuce. Lettuce is mostly what you can see right now.
This is a vertical farm. Bok choy, lettuce, and baby kale grow inside this building on towers that rise 5 meters off the floor. But each seedling starts its life in a crowded little nursery that is ablaze with lights.
Kind of looks like Christmas tree lights,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
There is no sunlight on this farm, but it's cozy warm in here. The LEDs glow green and red, purple and blue. They shine on trays of little baby plants.
In here, there's no stress. So we bring the plant in and we just say, like, how do we just get the best results, period? Like, what are the ideal conditions? And we just keep that growth rate at maximum the whole way through.
No stress. Just come in here and get as fat as you can.
Plant vacation, right? Their lives are very short, but they're very good.
After about a week, the seedlings are big enough to be moved onto the growing towers, where they will be bathed in artificial light pretty much around the clock. Vertical farms like this one are part of a young but growing industry. They've popped up in cities like Denver and New York. By one estimate, there are more than 2,000 of them in the United States. And later this spring, Plenty will open a new farm in Compton, California, that will produce 4.5 million pounds of leafy greens a year. One reason the industry is taking off? Water. This farm recycles nearly every drop of it.
The reality is, like, in the field, 99% of the water that the plant takes up is transpired, meaning they take it up to their leaves and then it just evaporates, right? In here, the plants are still doing that, but we capture all of that water. Mm.
Story says by doing so, vertical farming uses 90% less water than outdoor agriculture. And someday, he thinks it'll be 99% less.
Today, you know, this industry is all of like 4 or 5 years old. It's a technology industry, which means it changes very, very quickly. So if we're recirculating all of the water in the air, as well as all of the water in the system, we're down to like a fraction of 1%.
Put on your philosopher's hat for a second. How big of a deal would it be if you were to reach that?
Yeah, I mean, it just means that every unit of water can produce 100 times what it did, right? I mean, that's a big deal.
I think it's huge.
Murat Kasira runs a Center for Indoor Agriculture at the University of Arizona, which includes greenhouses and, more recently, vertical farms.
The role that controlled environment agriculture will play is going to be significant.
That's because the water crisis is growing more urgent. Soon after we met at the university's greenhouse in Tucson, 6 of the 7 states that rely on the Colorado River gave the federal government a plan to reduce their water use. But the state that draws the most from the river, California, didn't sign it. As tense negotiations drag on, it's clear that major cuts will be coming to the region's most important water supply.
We are challenged with a dynamic climate out there. It's not stable anymore.
Which Kasira says will put pressure on traditional agriculture to change. Inside his greenhouse, mature plants are dripping with luscious cherry tomatoes. An intern named Matt Castaneda is clipping a variety called Indigo Drops from the vine.
Just got to single out the ones that have the nice purple-red color.
Do you ever sneak a bite in every once in a while?
Hey, once in a while I do. This morning I was a bit hungry and I grabbed one and munched it.
I can't resist, because Sierra hands me a plump piece of fruit.
There you go.
It's another cherry tomato variety.
That's delicious.
That's beautiful.
The tomato is delicious, but Kasira is realistic about the challenges of growing indoors at a mass scale. Greenhouse technology is more mature than vertical farms, but both are expensive. That machine you hear is pumping nutrient-rich water into the irrigation system. The ventilation fans of this greenhouse are keeping the air fresh. And in a vertical farm, the lights are on all day long. How would you describe the power usage of a vertical farm?
It's significantly high compared to growing outdoors. That's the challenge that the whole research and the technology development is trying to address.
Is that like the holy grail?
Yeah, that's the bottleneck of the crop production, electrical energy needed for lighting or for air conditioning.
It's also a labor issue.
Well, there's a learning curve for sure. The workforce needed. Right now we are in huge demand for a skilled workforce. The automation needed, the labor is a big issue now.
Traditional field agriculture is perhaps the oldest industry that there is.
Sure.
I mean, we have been cultivating crops outdoors for as long as humans have been around, right? And yet this sort of thing is so profoundly new.
Uh-huh.
Could it ever replace all the production that is happening in the Imperial Valley of California and not far from here in Yuma, Arizona?
No, the answer is no. But I think the contribution, the collaboration of the controlled environment agriculture with field agriculture will be needed.
It will be a piece of the puzzle.
It will be a piece of the puzzle, but it will not replace field agriculture.
Back in San Francisco, it's pretty obvious that vertical farming is nothing like growing in a field. Inside the warehouse with Nate's story, I watch crews power washing a 5-meter tower that has just been plucked clean by the harvesting machine.
Yeah, you know, in the field you got a tractor, it's like going through, you might be harvesting multiple rows at once. Here we have a robot, it harvests a single row at a time.
And then we see the robot in action.
Well, look, a robot just brought another tower down to get harvested?
Yeah, that's right. So these big robots, they pick the towers, right? So they just lay it down, run it through the harvester, and then they'll pick it back up again once it's been cleaned and transplanted.
Wow, here it comes.
Story says the journey from seed to harvest can be up to twice as fast as growing lettuce outdoors. The greens that are harvested here will be packaged and sold in nearby grocery stores at a price comparable to organics. Someday soon, they'll be selling strawberries and tomatoes. But I still want to understand why Story is growing food this way. So before I leave the farm, we step away from the robots to go somewhere a little more quiet. This is what he told me.
I mean, this is like a reckoning for the United States, right? Because we've relied on the Colorado River for a very long time. But other parts of the world have already gone through this structural change. They've gone through this environmental shift, right? There are places in the world where desertification has already taken place, and their water resources are gone or depleted. For folks who have lost their water resources, this is something to look at.
But you also can't feed the world with bok choy, arugula, and strawberries, right?
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
What about wheat, soybeans, corn, things that really drive the agriculture industry in a big way?
Yeah, I mean, today it doesn't make sense. Like today I can't grow wheat and compete with the field. The field is very good at growing wheat. It's like one of our first crops, right? I'm competing with a very mature technology.
You'll try to go there someday? I mean, you think that's realistic to have a wheat field indoors?
Listen, I think we have to go there. And this is kind of like getting into crazy territory, and there's going to be a lot of people that say that guy's nuts. And by today's standards, I am nuts, right? That's a crazy claim to make. But this is a technology cost curve, right? Like people thought the ability to like have a supercomputer in your pocket would have been a crazy idea even 25 years ago.
You're holding an iPhone.
I'm holding an iPhone in my hand, right? And so like the beauty of technology cost curves is that they surprise you.
So then let me ask you, what is the risk or the consequence of not trying to do something as crazy as growing wheat indoors?
I think we have to. it has to be said, like, I view the technology we're developing as like an amazing opportunity to give people fresh, clean, healthy, amazing tasting food. I also view it as a life raft for our species.